When does a story end? I mean, truly end. Take, for example, the Hundred Years' War. For something in the region of 41 chapters of this podcast, we have tracked the story of this endless conflict with the French from the reign of King Edward III until now. And it's about now that this epic Hundred Years' War finally comes to an end. Supposedly. And it's also about now that the War of the Roses is meant to start. Supposedly. In truth, these divisions, these lines in the narrative are always, if we're lucky, added afterwards by historians trying to make sense of the past to explain it to people. And if we're unlucky, they're added by politicians trying to use the past to further their own cause. Even if politicians at the time were hereditary nobility, they were no different than politicians now. The past can and will be weaponized. The Hundred Years' War actually did not formally end in the 1450s. And the War of the Roses didn't really start here. There was just one crisis, and it involved both these things and more. I mean, afterwards, sure. Let's thematically change things around and add a full stop here and a new paragraph there. But at the time, to the people at the time, it was all just one big thing. And this big thing was a political crisis that was entirely instigated by King Henry VI. Honestly, the guy was useless. I mean, look at what London had just seen with Jack Cade and his rebellion, which we've covered over the last three chapters. He handled this rebellion so badly that the only thing he actually was handling worse at the time was the situation over in France, which was the basic cause of all his problems. Henry was a complete screw-up. And around him, other political actors were about to step in, but they also were complete screw-ups. And like it or not, London was on the ground floor of everything that was to come. It had a front row seat in the carnage that will be called the War of the Roses, and the opening salvos of this begin right here and right now. Hi there, my name is Saul, and this is The Story of London, the podcast that tries desperately to tell the history of the city as a single narrative tale, with one writer and one narrator taking us along the chronological story of this place. We've reached the years 1450 to about 1454, and we're about to see the first germination of seeds that were planted a few years previously, political ones, that is. The first barbs of the conflict to come. Welcome then to chapter 161 of this story of London, the four most triumphant entries of the Duke of York. So what London was about to face was a mixture of it trying to cope with some ropey personalities in charge of the nation, who in turn mixed with ropey personalities here in London. We start with the aftermath of Cade's rebellion. Remember, at the time, the king and his government were convinced Jack Cade's surname was actually Mortimer, and that he'd come from Ireland sent by the Duke of York. Therefore, it should come as no real surprise that the first crisis they'd hit after all of this was caused by the Duke of York. In September 1450, the Duke of York, who'd been based in Ireland, where he'd been for 3 years and change into a 10-year term of running the English territories in Ireland on behalf of the English king, decided to return unexpectedly, around the 7th of the month, into Wales. He crossed that country and then crossed the Midlands, and on the 27th of September, in 1450, Richard, Duke of York, arrived in London, entering the city leading a body of between 3,000 and 5,000 armed men under his banner. They came in huge pomp, their flags and banners flying, their drummers and musicians playing, and they marched in a formal military procession. The Duke and his men marched through the streets of London and then out of Aldgate and along Fleet Street and turned left at Charing Cross and down to Westminster, where he was received in a short meeting by his rather bewildered cousin, the King. York's armed parade through London, already trying to recover from the utter mayhem and anarchy caused by Jack Cade, where the signs of the vicious battle on London Bridge were still clearly visible, into a heightened state of tension. Why was he here? What brought him from Ireland? Why did he turn up with armed men? Why was the King looking so tense? Following his short meeting with King Henry at Westminster, the Duke of York lodged a few weeks at the home of the Bishop of Salisbury in London. And London was to discover why the Duke had arrived with such a show of force. So what followed was a huge miasma of a shit sandwich that was caused by two men really not understanding each other. To the King and the sycophants around him, the arrival of the Duke of York was an act of borderline rebellion. The Duke had been stationed to run Ireland. That was his job. He was meant to be over there, running things. Him turning up here, especially given all the claims from rebels that he should be king, this was a provocation. He was after something. What? Richard, Duke of York, well, he was quite clear what he was after. You see, while he'd been stationed over in Ireland and in France, the Duke of York had not been part of Henry VI's government, which was a good thing, as Henry VI's government had been a pile of crap. The incompetence of the Duke of Suffolk had happened mostly when he was abroad. All the news that reached him in Ireland told him that it was his duty, dare we say it, his destiny, to turn up, kick open the doors of Westminster and say, "Good morning, cousin, I'm here now. Put the kettle on, love, and I'll sort out your government for you really quickly." He wasn't rebelling, he was helping. "This is me, Majesty, helping you." My marching 5,000 armed men through Cheapside. Now, allow me to say, the Duke of York wasn't rebelling against King, no, but he wasn't an idiot. This was a show of force. It was arguably the most powerful noble in England, turning up and showing the King, "Look what I have, you should have me in charge of your government." The Duke of York wanted to be the King's right-hand man, and the King was simply not keen on the idea. The two men began to exchange letters, the Duke in the Bishop of Salisbury's house, the King in the Palace of Westminster. People will watch messengers go back and forth, like political Wimbledon. The Duke wrote to the King, pointing out that law and order appeared to be collapsing in England, and that because of that, quote, "I, your humble subject and liegeman, Richard, Duke of York, offer to execute your commandments," unquote. He was offering, in simplest terms, to take over command of the English government in its moment of crisis. And the reason we know this was, oh no, oh, looks like that letter was leaked. Somehow. Oh, would you know it? Someone leaked a copy of the private letter from the Duke of York to the King to the people of London. Oh no. I hope no one starts making copies of the letter and distributes them around London. Oh, they have? Oh, no. I hope no one sticks them to the walls and doors of prominent places around London so they become like a manifesto for the Londoners to get behind the Duke of York. Oh, they have? Oh, no. Yeah. The Duke of York was playing politics here, making sure London knew exactly why he was doing this, putting pressure upon the King, trying to galvanise people's support. Henry was not biting. He didn't really care about people's support. And he replied to the Duke of York that what was going to happen, he was going to establish a, quote, "sad and substantial council in which we've appointed you to be one," unquote. Yeah, the King was saying, yeah, you can join a ruling council. York was unhappy. This was not the King saying, "You know what, me old son, you take over now," was it? And in the meantime, the Duke of York stayed in London for a few weeks and made a few friends, and he influenced people. And we know he made friends because they would be part of the shenanigans that were about to come up. What friends? Well, we'll start with three brothers, a grocer called John Young and his two half-brothers, William and Thomas Canning. And they were all linked to the grocer's company. It's not clear when the close connection between Young, the Cannings, and the Duke of York began, but it probably a few years earlier when York was mortgaging land to raise some money, and William Canning and John Young, as well as William Venner, the grocer, were associated with him, his grant of Eastern in Gloucestershire, land that was eventually acquired by someone called Thomas Young. And who is Thomas Young? He was John Young's older brother, a legalist from Bristol, who had links to other grocers and was an up-and-coming lawyer. Thomas Young was hired to act as learned counsel for the grocers' company back in 1447 and 48. So you had the Youngs and the Cannings, who were rising in prominence in the grocers' company with links to the Duke of York from before he went to Ireland. And that means even before he turned up here in 1450, he had established close links with a small but influential faction amongst the grocers, and that the faction was bent on increasing its influence in the grocers' company and beyond that in the City of London. But we'll come back to these guys in a bit, because here now in late 1450, Richard the Duke of York was not getting the response out of the king he wanted. Because, you see, he had a fundamental problem. Someone was already doing the job he wanted to do and basically running the state in the name of the rather inept king. The Duke of Somerset. Who? Right. Edmund Buford. He was the Duke of Somerset, and he had returned recently from his catastrophic time in charge of the English forces on Normandy. Remember, the supposed big commanders in France had been in order since Henry V died. The Duke of Bedford, the brother of Henry V, then the aforesaid Duke of York, the cousin of Henry VI, and then the Duke of Somerset. And Somerset had been universally crap at this job, and he'd returned somewhat deflated after all he'd done is successfully lose Normandy. But rather than face the king being angry, he found himself basically in the job the Duke of York wanted, especially after the Duke of Surrey had been killed. In August, within just 14 days of returning from France, he was attending council meetings. By the September the 8th, he was put in charge of stamping out the embers of the revolt in Kent. On the September the 11th, he'd been appointed the Constable of England, the highest military post in the land. Just like the Duke of York, the Duke of Somerset was a kinsman of the king in that messy, extended royal family we spoke about a few episodes ago. Unlike the Duke of York, Somerset had close links to the Queen, Margaret, and he'd been just as close to Henry's late mother, Catherine de Valois. As a nephew of Cardinal Buford, he was basically a familiar figure to King Henry, whereas the Duke of York was more of an outsider. Somerset also had the benefit that he had no massive estates to manage. He was able to devote his full attention to the business of government, taking on all the tasks that had previously fallen to the Duke of Suffolk. Basically, running stuff for the king, being his right-hand man, doing the job the Duke of York wanted. And that fundamentally was the difference between the two men, and that fundamentally started a rivalry in English politics that would divide the nation for the next 5 years. It's basically a cat fight, with cats armed with swords. And all that meant was, in 1450, the Duke of York visited London, and all they got from it was an agitated sense of political tension. Aw, thanks, Your Grace. As they waited for Parliament to return on November, on the 29th of October, we had that incident where Mayor Wyfold ran into a bunch of 40 unemployed soldiers loitering around in the streets, and he demanded they hand over their weapons, and when they hesitated and say no, he ordered them attacked and arrested then and there. Wyfold was the first of the new militant line of London mayors. The militant London was trying to have none of that crap. But as you can see, you've also got a massive armed force turning up from the Duke of York, and there's confrontations between him going on, and yeah. Now, we know this militancy was built upon the city having just witnessed the popular insurrection cause murder, mass robbery, and a vicious battle on London Bridge that July. But it's still going on in the 30th of October and the 1st of November, because as the Parliament's about to come in, we start seeing emblems and arms for the Duke of York, and also emblems and arms for the King, begin appearing all over the city and the suburbs as partisans for both sides let everyone know who they supported. The city was becoming factionalized very quickly by the fights between the great and the good. And Mayor Wyfold suddenly had his hands full trying to keep a lid on the city. It's no wonder he ordered those soldiers arrested. In between this, Parliament started on the 6th of November and tensions rose even more. In Parliament, the followers of the two factions clashed at once. The Duke of York's Chamberlain, Sir William Oldhall, was chosen as the Speaker of the Commons. In the meantime, scuffles and fistfights were breaking out in the streets of London, it seems, as it was claimed chains had to be erected in the streets of the city in an attempt to limit the excesses of what the Chancellor, Cardinal John Kemp, described as, quote, the people of riotous disposition, unquote. The Duke of York, after having left London to tour his estates, returned with the Duke of Norfolk and a large number of men towards the end of the month. And again, nobility turning up with a large number of armed men increases the tension in the city. It's hard to avoid the sense that the capital was on the point of an eruption and that the fate of it hinged on the next action taken by the Duke of York. He arrived in Westminster on the 23rd of November, one day before John Mowbray, the Duke of Norfolk, his chief ally since his return from Ireland. Both men, and indeed all the lords who attended that November Parliament, brought with them large armed retainers. The author of one chronicle of this period describes seeing York come, quote, riding through the city, his sword borne afore him, a mark of great pomp and authority, unquote. This was the Duke of York's second most triumphant entry into London. Exactly like the last one, only this one he was sure the outcome would be better. There was an atmosphere of barely contained violence on the streets. One important element in this second attempt to place himself as the central figure of English politics was that York adopted the mantle of reformers and took a barely critical stance towards the traitors who would allow Normandy to be lost. No one at the time was under any illusions. When he said traitors, he meant the Duke of Somerset. On the 30th of November, a series of raucous arguments broke out within the Parliament chamber at Westminster Hall. Several MPs demanded that justice be brought against those who failed to protect the King's possessions in France. And a great shout was made in Westminster Hall for justice on traitors, allegedly engineered by Sir William Oldhall. London took one look and realised something was going to snap. And it did. During that session of Parliament, the Duke of Somerset was in London. He was staying at Blackfriars, the Dominican house within the western wall of the city, just next to Ludgate, at the point where the River Fleet met the Thames. It was a large complex. As well as the priory, there were other buildings, and one of the private homes within Blackfriars was where he was staying. On Tuesday, the 1st of December, while the Duke was eating, so around about 5 or 6 o'clock, a large band of soldiers attempted to break into the house in an attempt to arrest him. The danger to the Duke's life was so sudden and so intense that at once two men, the Earl of Devon, Thomas Courtney, and Mayor Wyfold, turned up to literally smuggle him out of the house, almost out of one side as a mob burst in on the other. They bundled him down to the riverside quay and hastily stuck him on a boat where he was instantly taken downriver. What saved him from this mob of armed men was a mixture of fast action by the mayor, but also, well, the rioters stuck around and took their time in looting his property. One source at the time commented, quote, and that day he was robbed of all his goods, and all his jewels were taken and borne away by many. And in the morrow they despoiled the places and lodgings of many diverse lords, and bade away all the goods that were with them. That is to say, Sir Thomas Strodham and Sir Thomas Who, the Lord Hastings, sometime Chamberlain of Normandy, unquote. So this was more than just one attack upon the Duke of Somerset. It appears to be the first round of a wave of factional violence erupting in London due to increased political tension. The result was the city was authorised to publicly execute a rioter, but London's streets now seized with nothing but growing protest and disaffection. It would take a big act to calm things down on the streets of London. But guess what? there was just that act. And the man who did it, Henry VI. The king ordered a parade of all the lords of England united, riding through London on the 3rd of December. As one chronicle put it, quote, upon the Thursday the next day, following the king with all the lords, came through the city all in harness, and the citizens standing upon every side of the street, which was the glorious sight that ever man in those days saw, unquote. All in harness means everybody was turning up in armour. This massive parade through London, right in the middle of a political crisis, was designed to show, hey, we're all on the same side, aren't we? The whole thing was a hollow gesture of unity. But Henry rode through the unruly capital with the Duke of York and almost all the nobility and gentry who were present at Parliament. And apparently everybody just bowed their heads in obedience. The city got to witness an impressive array of military strength, many thousands of men strong. But as another writer at the time put it, quote, a noble sight indeed, if it had taken place over in France, unquote. This display did do one thing. It calmed down the feverish atmosphere on the streets. However, the problems which had led to the impeachment of Suffolk and to the rebellion of Jack Cade were still ongoing. London's mood began to cool. York's pandering to the populace had won him no favour whatsoever with the majority of the lords. He remained close to the Duke of Norfolk, but when Christmas came, Parliament recessed and the streets definitely calmed down. York began finding any support he had drifting away. In the new year, the Duke of Somerset resumed control of the government, this time with a few successes. He took the king into the Shires to suppress another uprising, this led by someone called Stephen Christmas, and it was followed by a further exemplary punishment of rebels elsewhere. And after Christmas, Henry, emboldened by the Duke of Salisbury, began to actually start acting like a king should. By the midsummer of 1451, Henry's combination of few concessions to public opinion and unusually firm personal action in the Shires had restored a measure of strength to his government. And during this time, Richard, the Duke of York, was noted for his complete absence and lack of involvement in the state. With the war going on, the king focused on the renewed French attacks on Gascony, while Londoners paid the tax for the relief of Calais on the 17th of July 1451, providing enough funds to supply 1,000 men. In any case, these problems of Gascony and Calais were quickly overshadowed by, well, an urgent need for considerable armed forces back at home. And to explain what was going on, in the September of 1451, Richard, Duke of York, was now based in his castles and his estates. Somerset was in charge. And the Duke of York came across more and more to resemble a rabble-rouser rather than an agent of peace and stability. He retained influence as it was his supporters who were currently in control of Parliament, and his personal chancellor was the Speaker of the House of Commons, Sir William Oldhall. He was a veteran of the wars in France. He'd come over during the Agincourt campaign and later earned his spurs. He'd been knighted himself by the Duke of Bedford. It was following Bedford's death in September 1435 that Oldhall entered the service of the Duke of York, the King's new Lieutenant General in France and Normandy from 1436 onwards. Even though he was 16 years older than the Duke of York, he became a close advisor to his new lord, who would go on to appoint him, as we said, his personal chamberlain. Oldhall was a prominent politician, and with his help, while Somerset ran the state and the government, and the king was looking manly for the first time in his life, with Oldhall as speaker, the Duke of York and his allies were able to influence much of what was being discussed in Parliament. But they went too far. In what was to become the final session of that Parliament of May 1451, the Duke of York's legal counsellor, Thomas Young, proposed a petition that the Duke should become the childless King Henry's heir presumptive. The vote carried, and the King hit the roof, deeply offended. And yes, that is Thomas Young, who's linked to that cabal of London grocers. He was the man who had been an advocate of the grocer's company. And here we see a small bunch of Londoners become intimately involved in the Duke of York shenanigans. The worshipful company of grocers of London did not want to be a political organisation. It had always been first and foremost a trading organisation, which put its trading interests, even the needs of shopkeepers outside of the livery, before any overt political ambitions. It, in principle, liked to stay neutral. Now, as we've covered across the myriad history of this city, since its richer members had become aldermen and ward representatives, it of course had political repercussions and implications right across its history. And as had happened in the past, commercial interests were widening the political divide between its members. You had the brother and half-brothers of Thomas Young, with links to the Duke of York, seeking to increase their influence. You had the staplers, whose grocers had managed to make their fortunes running the monopoly of wool into and out of the compulsory wool market in Calais. You had younger members of the company who faced the glass ceiling of the prevailing economic conditions we covered a few episodes ago, and that prevented them from expanding. These were disparate groups, but each found common cause with one another to oppose the policies of the king. Thomas Young and the other supporters of the Duke of York were able to win the backing of the House of Commons in May 1451 for Young's motion to secure that Parliament recognises the Duke of York as the king's heir. But in doing it, it so angered the king that he promptly A, dismissed Parliament, and then imprisoned Thomas Young in the Tower of London for his sheer audacity. Young's incarceration was one more grievance for his brothers. Thomas Canning and John Young had little cause to love the government of Henry VI, and his imprisonment caused a reaction. It can hardly be a coincidence that within 2 months of Young's arrest, his younger brother John was nominated as one of the four candidates with whom the mayor and the alderman had to choose a new alderman for Dowgate for. This gave his fellow grocer, the mayor, Nicholas Wyford, a teeny bit of a nightmare. John Young was not selected. This non-selection of John Young could have had many explanations. It could be that the alderman council was divided by those who did not support the Duke of York and those who wanted to shake up the status quo. And those who did not support Young's nomination may not have necessarily been fans of the Duke of Somerset and the King. They could have just been realists. London aldermen, made up of mercers and drapers, who took one look at the optics of electing a known partisan of the Duke of York, whose brother was in the frickin' Tower of London, and they would have pointed out to the mayor that the Duke of York had failed in his attempt to place himself at the head of the royal government. So let's not provoke the Duke of Somerset, eh? Whatever the reason, John Young was not made an alderman, but his faction was growing in importance and would be joined by others. And you see, Mayor Wyfold, at the same time, also wanted to increase the number of grocer aldermen in the city, strengthening their position within the London's government. And partly this was because of the endless complaints from the wool dealers in the company to the king's continued granting of licenses to evade the stable. But there was another really big reason for this. The royal minister's schemes for raising money were posing another threat to the grocer's trade. In 1450, all the alum which Genoese merchants had imported into Southampton was seized by the king's command. This had the object of forcing the Genoese to pay the king £8,000 in goods immediately, with a promise of repayment in the future by relief from the customs. But the king didn't want this alum. He wanted the coin this alum could give him. So his scheme required that London's merchants should buy the alum off him. And in June 1451, the king requested Nicholas Wyfold to oversee the sale by an arrangement which involved a, quote, usurious loan, unquote. The bottom line was the king basically said, you owe me £8,000. The grocers went, what? We don't have that much. And he said, nah, I'll tell you what we'll do. I'll charge 10% interest on it. You give me £800. You can pay the rest when you can. The grocers had no inclination to do this, not least of which because most of their money was tied up in loans to the Calais staple. The company's response to this seemed to have, well, prevaricated. But in the meantime, they took another step towards strengthening the position in the city's government when the not openly Yorkist Richard Lee was appointed sheriff, which led to his succession as an alderman. The company found, though, it could not escape the increasing royal pressure for cash. Matters came to a head in the summer of 1453, when the grocers were summoned no fewer than 3 times to Westminster to discuss the matter of purchasing the alum with the King's Council. Even so, this was not resolved, and the King was still pressing them on the August of 53, besides demanding other loans to relieve the desperate crisis in France. From the tone of royal letters, there's more than a hint of menace. The grocer's company had already been made aware that failure to cooperate with the King could have unpleasant results, so they were looking to grow their power, and the pro-Yorkist Young and Canning brothers were riding on the coattails of this desire. And in the meantime, something else in London kicked off, and this is where we bring Sir William Oldhole back into London's story. While it is commonly accepted that the Duke of York had been personally behind that petition that Thomas Young introduced, it is possible that the Speaker of the House of Commons played a part in prompting Young to present it. And in the months following that Parliament, allegations about Oldhole's part in his master's political manoeuvrings steadily escalated. Fearful for his safety, at dawn of the 2nd of November, Oldhole fled to the sanctuary of the Church of St. Martin le Grand. Now, the Church of St. Martin le Grand stood in the northwest quarter of the City of London. We mentioned it gaining its charter all the way back in Chapter 49 of this podcast, Concord, when the former clerk of Edward the Confessor, Engelek, had gained the rights to create a church. And in the centuries since then, other places had been built up around it. These days, this collegiate church was abutting Greyfriars Priory on one side and Goldsmiths Hall on the other. But it was still a place of prickly independence. You see, anyone entering the collegiate church claiming the right of sanctuary could, if their request was granted, be hidden inside the precincts, shielded by charters of privilege which had long ago been granted to its inhabitants. For this reason, the Collegiate Church of St. Martin le Grand had for years been a favourite hideaway for escaped prisoners, ne'er-do-wells and wanted men. If you're on the run from the law, you could hide out in St. Martin's. Oldhole had found himself stumbling into the place because, as the dean of the college would later write, he was driven, quote, by fear of heavy imprisonment and greatly alarmed for his life, unquote. And he had good reason to be afraid. He'd been accused, most immediately, by an esquire of Somerset called Walter Burr, of having taken part in the looting of Somerset's possessions from his house on Blackfriars in 1450. But to this was added wild allegations that he'd been plotting on York's behalf to stage a coup d'etat in which the king was to be kidnapped. Some of these charges were highly improbable, but Oldhole's fear for his life was very, very real, and thus he made his way to St. Martin le Grand, and thus, by ancient rules of London, he was safe. However, on the night of the 18th of January following, Walter Burr, the man who accused him, was attacked in the street in London by 3 strangers and left for dead. And in response to this, the Duke of Somerset really badly overreacted. He sent a high delegation to St. Martin's, including the Earls of Salisbury, Wiltshire and Worcester, along with 2 barons, 1 of London's sheriffs and a posse of armed servants. These men broke into the church shortly before midnight. They were, in the Dean's pious words, quote, armed with grievous force, not having the fear of God before their eyes, unquote. And they proceeded to smash, quote, all the doors and chests, unquote, looking for Oldhole's hideaway. Eventually, concealed in the nave of the church, they found him. Sir William was dragged out, loaded onto a horse and bundled off to Westminster, there to be interrogated for his crimes. But please remember, this is London. They do not take breaches of the law of sanctuary lightly here. As we saw all the way back in Chapter 79, when the Archbishop of Canterbury had violated a church sanctuary to take out William Longbeard, this kind of crap was not accepted. It was illegal and it was offensive to God, you twats. Oldhole's removal instantly caused the tensions on the street to suddenly and spontaneously explode. And so great were the objections and outrage and protests at St. Martin le Grand that within 48 hours he'd been returned and placed back under holy protection. He was going to remain there for the next 3 years. However, Altall's removal from sanctuary had been an escalation, and in response to it, the Duke of York then decided he would stage an escalation. And oh boy, did he ever. Clearly furious at the Duke of Somerset for doing what he did, the Duke of York sent letters to most of the towns in southern England, demanding they join in an orderly march upon London to remove Somerset from power in the name of restoring good governance to the realm. Once again, the Duke of York used written words to provide him a manifesto. He insisted that he was, quote, the king's true liegeman and servant, and ever shall be to my life's end, unquote. He wished to raise his quarrel with Somerset above the personal. He stressed the importance of the common good for the country at large. And he placed his personal enmity with the Duke of Somerset in the context of a larger struggle for the basic survival of England. Quote, seeing that the said Duke ever prevaileth and ruleth about the king's person, and by this means the land is likely to be destroyed, I am fully concluded to proceed in all haste against him, with the help of my kinsmen and friends, in such wise that it shall provide to promote ease, peace, tranquillity, and safeguard all of this land, unquote. Or so he wrote. Then, as his letters circulated south, York ordered the tenants of his scattered estates to take up arms and to march once again with him to London. This was to be his third most triumphant entry into the city. This was to be the winner. And yet, alas for him, both Somerset and the king had no shits to give at this point. They would not back down. As York marched south at the end of February, Somerset brought the king and an armed retinue out to meet him. The king was joined by a large number of bishops and at least 16 other lords, including three of the most senior dukes in the land, the Dukes of Exeter, Buckingham and Norfolk, who was York's supposedly erstwhile ally. It was a show of near total unity from the lords. Leaving London on the 16th of February with instructions to the city to close its gates to the Duke of York, Henry marched north via Barnet, St. Albans and Dunstable to reach Northampton on the 22nd of February. When he got there, he got intelligence that York had got the drop on him and across the Thames by Kingston Bridge. The king marched back to the city, crossed over London Bridge to Southwark the next day, and on the 1st of March, the main royal force was finally drawn up on Blackheath, same place where Jack Cade's rebels had defied the king in June 1450. It was getting a lot of action these days. Meanwhile, the Duke of York eventually brought his several thousand men to rest about 8 miles to the east at Dartford. London had refused passage to the Duke of York's herald. The mayor was acutely aware that the city owed the king £8,000 because of this bloody alum deal, and he could not afford to throw support to the Duke in the face of this, even if he wanted to. Let me be clear. The Duke of York had come expecting a fight. His forces were supplemented by an impressive artillery train, and he was supported by the Earl of Devon to the south and Lord Cobham north towards the river, and there were 7 ships with supplies for a campaign on the Thames. In spite of the strength of York's army, Henry's force was much stronger. According to one eyewitness, it was 3 times the size of the Duke of York's. Henry VI, you see, had an ample warning on this occasion to prepare for his first military confrontation with his cousin of York. But Richard of York's real issue was that he did not expect so many of the nobles to side against him. He clearly thought they'd all be on his side. And they weren't. Ah. Negotiations took place on the 1st and 2nd of March. York presented a long list of grievances, but his complaints crucially did not move any of the other lords. Far from being handed control of the government and Somerset's head, York was taken to London, effectively a prisoner. The Duke was humiliated in public. His third entry into London was therefore most non-triumphant. At a ceremony in St. Paul's Cathedral, which was packed, He was forced to swear a long oath of allegiance to the crown. He announced himself to be a, quote, humble subject and liegeman, unquote, to the king, and promised to bear him, quote, faith and truth as my sovereign lord, unquote, and to do all of this while laying his hands on holy gospels and then on the altar cross, and finally he took communion to confirm the oath. He'd been outplayed. Henry VI was in charge, and the king was looking good at this point. Yes, there were problems. Beyond London, here and now, England was becoming increasingly unstable. Scattered uprising and violent protests continued to break out across the land, in Suffolk, in Kent, in Warwickshire, in Lincolnshire, in Norfolk. Law and order appeared to be breaking down. What didn't help was separate armed disputes started erupting between the richer and more powerful families of Derbyshire and Gloucester and East Anglia. The West Country again was convulsed due to the ongoing and renewing dispute between the Courtenays and the Bonvilles. In Warwickshire, the arrival of a new lord, Richard Neville, the Earl of Warwick, resulted in several serious disturbances. While in Yorkshire, you saw the escalation between Neville's extended family and the traditionally dominant Percy family grow, a dispute that would become, by the mid-1450s, something like a northern civil war. This breakdown in law and order, and also the breakdown in relations between the landed nobility, gradually undermined their ability to stand together as they did at Dartford in March of 1452. In the short term, however, the faith of the political community of London lay with Edmund, Duke of Somerset, rather than with Richard, Duke of York. And for the second time in 18 months, York's efforts to impose himself on the crown in the name of the common good had come to nothing. And so, the dynamic duo of Henry VI and the Duke of Somerset now had their own version of a mandate. And Henry, out of nowhere, suddenly seemed to be becoming a vigorous and energetic king. Law and order remained a problem, but he started to make some progress. The Earl of Shrewsbury was sent to Kent and kind of stopped all the steam of the rebellions in that county. Judicial proceedings were launched against those who supported York in what he tried to do in Dartford, including the complete destruction of Sir William Oldhall, who may be staying alive in St. Martin le Grand, but he lost most of his property and he was declared an outlaw. York's position as a lieutenant of Ireland was given to James Butler, the young Earl of Ormond. And in a further mark of confidence, the court toured the marches of Wales and the east of England. This was York's territory, but here was the king dispersing justice and bringing him into the very view of his people. And then came news of success over across the Channel. Early in 1452, the government had begun to suggest seriously that the king might lead a military campaign to rescue what remained of English possessions in Gascony personally. Yeah, right, that was never going to happen. But in October 1452, news arrived that an advance force that had been sent under the formidable Earl of Shrewsbury, John Talbot, had won several quite amazing victories. Bordeaux had been recaptured from the French with ease, and much of the area around the city were rallying back to the English flag. This was the best news to come out of France in over a year, and when Parliament met at Reading in March 1453, it responded generously to this great news, voting not just to grant the king his yearly subsidy, but that a new tax payable on wool exports should be paid every year for the rest of his life to the king. We'd not seen that since the reign of Edward I. The Parliament also received a petition concerning two young men who had managed to grow up in relative quiet amidst all this turbulence and danger way over in Bermondsey Abbey, Edmund and Jasper Tudor. The Parliament of 1453 successfully moved to declare them legitimate half-brothers of the king, and they were appointed Earls of Richmond and Pembroke. I mean, let's ignore the fact that being half Welsh and half French, neither had a single drop of English blood in their veins. They and their heirs were confirmed in the right to hold property and titles. In a highly unsubtle dig towards the Duke of York, lands seized from the now ruined Sir William Alden were granted as part of Jasper, Earl of Pembroke's new landed estates. At almost the same time came the best news of all. In the early spring of 1453, Queen Margaret, who had been for so long the object of public derision because of her inability to produce an heir, became pregnant. Even allowing and taking on board the risks that went with childbirth and the insanely high levels of child mortality, there was a genuine prospect that England would have a direct heir to the crown. And all these debates about which one of the dukes was most important would actually wither away. The Queen was delighted and thankful, and on discovering her pregnancy, immediately set out for Walsingham in Norfolk to give thanks at the famous shrine to the Virgin Mary. All England was moved in happiness. Things were finally going right. However, on the 17th of July 1453, in a field near Castillon, a town on the banks of the River Dordogne, just 26 miles east of Bordeaux, an English army, under the command of Talbot, was annihilated by cannon and cavalry of a French army commanded by Jean Bouroux. This battle is famed in European history as the first one where field artillery dictated the outcome. Talbot, the brilliant veteran of half a century of warfare, who was nicknamed the English Achilles and the terror of the French, was slaughtered alongside thousands of his men, marching headlong into a hail of artillery fire. The English were entirely routed, and within 3 months, Bordeaux would once again fall to the French. This was to prove, although nobody knew it at the time, a final unequivocal defeat in a war that had raged since 1337. It was greeted in England as a calamity, but no one could have conceived how the king would react to it. That August, as the court was touring the West Country, the king was staying in his hunting lodge in Clarendon near Salisbury, and it was here that Henry VI was told of this defeat. And his response was that he fell into a form of stupor. He went catatonic. He just went silent. This sudden catatonia struck so quickly and overwhelmingly that nobody knew what to do. For several weeks they managed to keep it a secret, but when he failed to recover, it became impossible to conceal this illness. He became completely helpless. He recognized no one. He had no sense of time. He could not speak or respond in any way to questions. They discovered he could not feed himself. They discovered he could not clean himself. He had no control of his arms or his legs. He couldn't even keep his head up. No physician could stir him. No medicine could stimulate him. What had caused this? We honestly do not know. We know his grandfather, Charles VI of France, King Charles the Mad, also suffered from numerous bouts of insanity. But in the cases of Charles the Mad, that had seen him, you know, scream incoherently, cover himself in his own shit, run deranged through royal palaces, and attack servants and staff with swords. Henry of England was just catatonic and mute. He became a nothing, and he stayed like that for 15 months. Instantly, England was effectively kingless. Holy shit. Now he was so obviously indisposed, this gave the Duke of Somerset and the rest of his councillors a huge problem. A small cabal of yes-men running the country was possible provided they had a king there to justify it, even if the king was little more than a glove puppet. But all of a sudden, the king was like a newborn baby. And now England was back to the situation it had been back in the 1420s when the king was a newborn baby. There was a royal person who could reign, but he had no ability whatever to rule. And as such, as we saw 30 years before, a communal response was required. Although there was a crisis growing in France, the political reaction to Henry's illness was to just delay making any decisions for as long as they could. Possibly they hoped he'd recover, and if not, then at least wait to see what happens with the Queen's pregnancy. And with that, on the 13th of October 1453, the holy feast day of Edward the Confessor, in a chamber nearby his shrine in Westminster Palace, Margaret of Anjou was delivered of her first child, a boy. He was named Edward, after both the saint and more glorious kings of past times. At this point, the bells in every London church rang for joy, and inside the churches, Te Deums were sung by all. The birth was a course of genuine celebration, but it was also clear that his father's state could no longer be ignored. The nation needed a working government. His mental collapse had coincided with, and may have indeed contributed to, a huge escalation of violence, particularly in the north of England. The Nevilles and the Percys conflict reached a new height. The north of England was on the brink of a civil war, and all pleas and demands to cease issued by Somerset's government had been completely ignored. As soon as Prince Edward was born, a great council of all the senior lords and churchmen in England was summoned to meet as soon as possible. And when the Duke of York arrived at Westminster on the 12th of November, his fourth most triumphant entry into the city, he didn't come in the mood to be conciliatory. His first action was to have his on-off ally, the Duke of Norfolk, launch a vehement attack upon Somerset before the council, once again accusing him of treason and losing France. Norfolk demanded Somerset's imprisonment, and in the confusion and the crisis of the moment, browbeaten by his aggressive demands, a majority of the assembled lords consented. The Duke was arrested and sent to the Tower to await trial. After several years of failure, York appeared to be finally at the centre of affairs. Not that this move went unchallenged. In January 1454, the Queen, having recovered from the birth of Prince Edward, made her own bid for power. Margaret had long been close to Somerset, and she clearly intended to resist the Duke of York. She had one weapon. She possessed the heir to the throne. Her newborn Edward was a bedrock upon which she could build a rival power base to the Duke of York. In the new year, she published a, quote, Bill of Five Articles, unquote, in which she demanded to, quote, have the whole rule of this land, unquote, as well as the right to appoint all the great officers of state, the sheriffs, the bishops, the whole nine, to basically become regent. Margaret's efforts were very bold, and they could well have worked, but a week later, Margaret's close ally, Cardinal Kemp, the Archbishop of Canterbury and Chancellor of England, dropped dead. At this, in absolute desperation, the Lords of England sent another delegation to the King to see if this news could coax from him some indication of whom he wished to be the new Archbishop. Once again, they reported to Parliament that they could get, quote, no answer nor sigh, unquote. The Lords left him, quote, with sorrowful hearts, unquote. The crisis had reached a peak. England needed a leader right now. On the 27th of March, the Lords in Parliament agreed to elect Richard, Duke of York, as protector of the realm and chief counsellor. His rise was complete. There were many who had huge reservations about York's suitability for the role as protector, and yet at this point, having finally gained the power he wanted and needed so desperately, Richard Duke of York actually began acting rather brilliantly. Although he appointed as his new Chancellor Richard Neville, the Earl of Salisbury, who was the patriarch of the Neville dynasty, he generally tried to be tough, even-handed and non-partisan in solving the fight between them and the Percys. He went in person to the north to make a serious attempt at arbitrating their conflict. And in the course of this, he even imprisoned his own son-in-law, the rather violent Henry Holland, the Duke of Exeter. York appointed himself captain of Calais and resumed his lieutenancy of Ireland. And he gave out titles and land on a non-partisan line, that the Queen got some, the Duke of Buckingham, Jasper and Edmund Tudor, all received lands and offices during York's protectorship, whereas men supposedly closer to him, such as the Earl of Salisbury's eldest son, the Earl of Warwick, also called Richard Neville, got nothing. Yet there was one glaring area in which York's policy of peace and attempted reconciliation failed to materialise. He could not normalise relations with Edmund Beaufort, the Duke of Somerset. Throughout 1454, Somerset remained locked away in the Tower, The Duke of York clearly wanted to kill Somerset, but he couldn't, as this would have caused instability. Thus, the two men continued to dance around one another. For London, the most important thing York's government did was establish his control over Calais. Calais was garrisoned now by the largest single army in the pay of the crown. And simply put, whoever won the allegiance of the troops there had at his disposal the potential means of dominating the entire kingdom. In turn, the loyalty of the garrison was decided by who the hell would pay its wages, which were almost permanently in arrears. York could not raise the money himself, and so he negotiated with the mayor of the staple, Robert White. White's factions amongst the London staplers was demanding the end to the bullion and partition ordinances, as well as the enforcement of the staple's monopoly. And in return for York's support here, the staplers agreed in April 1454 to lend £10,000 to pay the garrison. This loan and accompanying agreement only strengthened the Yorkist loyalties of the leading grocers, John Walden and Alan Johnson, who supported White's faction amongst the staplers. Walden now launched himself on the political career in the city. He'd served as the city's members of commons in 1453 and 4. He was appointed a sheriff in 1453, and he was an alderman by the following year. And as we said, the Youngs and the Cannings were part of this grocer's faction who were aligned to the Duke of York. And so it seems that the stapler faction of wool merchants, upon whom the wealth of Calais was so important, was now allying with them. The grocers were becoming more and more Yorkists. And during the Protectorate, the Duke of York had done much to woo the support of the Londoners. Foreign merchants were pressured to pay city-based taxes and fees that London had been demanding for years. More importantly, symbolically and physically, the Genoese were humbled. After years of successfully resisting the payment of scavenge, the Genoese merchants finally agreed to pay an annual sum to London, and it was clear that the reason for their submission was that they can no longer rely on the protection of the crown. Yet, despite these efforts, London was by no means universally Yorkist. It's just that a lot did like him for what he was doing. And then, suddenly, the king got better. Ah. Seriously? Yeah, seriously. And everything was about to get much, much worse. And we'll leave it there. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. All right, here we go. It's War of the Roses. A couple of announcements to make. First things first, I was asked by the wonderful people over at Ask Historian on Reddit, a brilliant forum over there, to appear on their podcast. And I did. And if you go on Ask Historian, you will hear me talking to the great host about the story of London. And in particular, we ended up talking for a whole hour about pre-Norman London. And it was really fun. Some really good questions, I felt. I hope my answers are interesting. So that's out there. So if you want to listen to that, please do. And you can also keep up to date with the story of London and ask me questions and stuff on my Blue Sky, the story of London. That's on Blue Sky. Check me out, and yeah, we'll take from there. Right, it's the War of the Roses. Hang on to your hats, people. It's going to get wild. This is Saul, hoping you had a great week. See you then. Bye.